The talk. And so what I'm going to talk about, which is actually based on this recent paper by Yeri Manin, is in a sense a proposal which is in many ways at a very early stage of development thinking. So but a proposal to try to use techniques and methods from algebraic geometry to give a sort of general framework where you can talk about cosmological models where you want to basically glue together two spacetimes across some kind of singularity. And so I'll give some examples of things like that that might fit into this general way of thinking. So that's the idea, try to make a sort of framework that accommodates models of this sort. And so let me first, so first of all, why algebraic geometry comes in any way? And so to try to convince you that it makes sense to want to using methods from algebraic geometry in talking about things that, I mean, cosmology, of course, is basically at the very where you want to have something that accommodate general relativity, and the usual way of thinking about general relativity is in terms of differential geometry and, well, Riemannian or rather Lorentzian geometry, so metric differential geometry, which is pretty far from algebraic geometry in a sense. But there's a nice way to connect the two, which actually goes back quite a while. It's not new, and it goes back to the 70s and the early developments of twister theory, and the basic geometric setup that connects algebraic geometry to general relativity is that there's a nice way of thinking of Lorentzian things, and in particular, let's just look first of all at the prototype thing, which is just flat Minkowski four-dimensional space, as something that sits naturally inside an algebra geometric thing. So the setup is like this. So you start with some four-dimensional complex vector space, no metric whatsoever around, just a vector space structure. And you look at a very natural kind of algebraic variety associated to a vector space, which is a Grassmannian. And in this case, it's the Grassmannian of two planes inside the four-dimensional space. So it's the space that parameterizes all the choices of a complex two-dimensional plane inside your complex four-dimensional space. And there's a tautological two-plane bundle over the Grassmannian, which is just the one that over a point associates the corresponding two-dimensional space that the point represents. And moreover, if you have if you take the dual vector space, you can look at those points in the Grassmannian where the point in the fiber of this space is annihilated by the corresponding space. So that's like the dual is in a sense is a dual to this tautological plane bundle. So you have two kind of plane bundles that come naturally associated to this complex Grassmannian. And so those bundles really have a more geometric way to think of, a more differential geometric way to think of those is that they are the two parts of the spinor bundle over a four-dimensional manifold. Rather, when you restrict it to the real point, it would be the two parts of the spinor bundle on a four-dimensional manifold. In fact, what happens is that if you take the trivial vector bundle with fiber, the four-dimensional space itself, it decomposes into these two pieces, these two parts of the spinor bundle. And you have an identification of the one forms with the tensor of these two parts. And so the particular one forms act by Clifford multiplication on the, by what is, in differential geometric terms, Clifford multiplication on the spinors. And the matrices that define this action are the what you normally call the gamma matrices. So you recover. Yeah, so if you are on a four-dimensional manifold, your spinor bundle decomposes into the S plus and S minus, and the Dirac operator maps one of them to the other. And so here you see those pieces in this decomposition. And in fact, there's also a natural way to see the Dirac operator as interchanging these two parts. I mean, you see the gamma matrices, so the Dirac operator is constructed out of that. And so the way that Minkowski space lives in this picture is that, so first of all, you can also find a metric on this, and the way to, in this algebra geometric setting to get something that will, so what you want is something that when you restrict it to what will be the Minkowski space sitting inside here, will give you the usual Lorentzian signature metric on that. And, or a Lorentzian signature metric if you change how you pick the, so the data that you want that will do that are a pair of holomorphic sections of over the Grassmannian of the bundles that are the lambda two of the two parts of the spinor bundle. And so if you pick a section of both and you combine them together, that gives you a tensor over this Grassmannian. And that will be the thing that will restrict to a Lorentzian signature metric on the Minkowski space. And the way, so I haven't told you yet where the Minkowski space is, so here it comes. Well, the Grassmannian has, one of the nice things that these varieties have, Grassmannians, that they have a nice cell decomposition. So they decompose into affine spaces. And a way to get a cell decomposition of the Grassmannian is you first pick the big cell, so the one that is the affine space that's dense, and then you cover the rest, the boundaries that are with other lower dimensional cells. The way to get a big cell is you choose one, so this is the Grassmannian parameterizes the two-dimensional planes inside this four-dimensional space. So you choose one two-dimensional plane, and you look at all those other ones that intersect it in the most general position, so all those that intersect your given plane only at the origin. And that gives you an open dense cell, which is an affine space, and that's the big cell of the Grassmannian, and then you will get the other cells by getting more, less generic intersections with your given choice. So what you do is, okay, you make a choice of a big cell, and then you look at the real points. So then, what you mean looking at the real points is that you also choose an involution on the Grassmannian, which defines a real structure, and you look at the fixed points of that involution. It's actually, there's not a unique way to choose the involution, so you have to choose it the right way, but I mean, if you do that, then what you get is a four-dimensional space, which has the property that those kind of tensors restrict to it as a Lorentzian signature matrix. So you get an actual Minkowski space embedded inside the Grassmannian, and this choice of a two-plane that you do to pick the big cell is a point in the Grassmannian, the two-plane is a point in the Grassmannian, and you call that the point at infinity. So it's the point of infinity of your Minkowski space-time. And so there's other stuff in the compactification of the Grassmannian. As I say, I'm just looking at the big cell. There are boundary strata in the compactification of the Grassmannian. And in particular, they give you a compactification, so a boundary at infinity of the Minkowski space. And the way that boundary at infinity works, so you're now looking at what's left of the Grassmannian once you remove the big cell. So what is left is actually a complexified light cone of this point at infinity. And it's a cone that has, it's a complex cone that has, the base of the cone is the product of two projective spaces, which are, there are two P1s, because I mean they are the projectivizations of the fiber of these two spinor bundles over the point at infinity. Each of them is a two-plane bundle, so you get two P1s. So it's a product, it's a cone over a product of P1s. And the thing, so when you look at the real points, so this is the compactification of the complex big cell, so the complex four-dimensional space-time. When you look at the real points, the real involution is actually not the one that picks the real points in each P1, but it's an involution that exchanges the two P1s. So you actually have as a fixed point the diagonal sitting inside the two. So the fixed point is actually one copy of P1, which is like the sphere at infinity. So it's the usual light cone in the sense of it's the sphere at infinity of a light, the light like cone of this point at infinity in as a, you know, this compactification of the four-dimensional Minkowski space. So what I have in mind is that when you look at the real points of this picture, what you see is this kind of usual Penrose diagrams that describe, you know, boundary at infinity of space-time, of Lorentzian space-time. There's a, actually, as I mentioned, this way of looking at Minkowski spaces inside algebra geometric objects. It was actually closely related to the construction of twister theory. And the way it's related to twister is that you think of this four-dimensional space as what you use to construct the dual twister space. And the construction goes like this. You have the Grassmannian here, where the space-time lives. The space-time is on this side. And you also have another variety, which is the flag variety. So that's this Grassmannian parametrizes two planes inside for a four-dimensional space. Now you look at the flag variety that parametrizes choices of a line inside the plane, inside the four-dimensional space. And this has two projections. One here where you forget the line and you only keep the information of the plane, but it has another projection on the other side where you forget the plane and you keep the information of the line. So it also projects to the Grassmannian of lines inside a four-dimensional space, but that's just a projective space in the three-dimensional projective space. And so this is the twister space. So this double projection is what Penrose called the twister transform, and it allows you to move things that you know about space-time here to the twister space by pulling back by this map and pushing forward by the other map. So the way that the twister space and the space-time geometry are dual to each other is through this twister transform diagram. And there's another useful thing in this picture, which I will use later on, is the fact that the Grassmannian has a natural way of sitting inside the projective space. And it sits the Grassmannian of two. So this is a complex four-dimensional manifold. Its set of real points is a real four-dimensional manifold. And it sits inside a five-dimensional projective space. And the way it's, there's a particular embedding that does that, which is called the Plucker embedding. I will come back to it later with some more explicit details when I'll need it, but it's a very standard way of realizing Grassmannians as subvarieties of projective spaces. And the image of this embedding is called the Klein quadric. And there's some useful things if you think of it this way. One is that, for example, if you want to construct a Lorentzian metric on this four-dimensional space that sits inside the Grassmannian, as I said, the way to do it is to construct certain sections of these bundles and put them together and then restrict it to the real locus. And one way to do it is to, so you want sections of some bundles that live here, is to see whether those bundles are coming from something that lives here. The reason is because, you know, bundles on the projective spaces are, you know, much easier to understand. And in fact, the bundle of which you want to construct a section here is a pullback of this bundle on P5, which is all minus two. And you know that any section of that bundle is going to have certain kind of poles. And if you look at what that means here, it means that you get a metric that is going to blow up at a certain kind of locus. And this locus, you can realize it as being a light cone, which is going to be your light cone at infinity. So you have a good way of producing a metric that is blowing up at infinity. And so you get something that, you know, has that kind of behavior. You get a Lorentzian space-time that has some kind of behavior where the metric is blowing up at infinity just by, you know, playing around with the algebraic geometry of this embedding and what you know about bundles on a projective space. And also, I mean, from this embedding, one can see that the image, the Klein quadric, has rulings by two families of planes. So you can imagine it as a quadric. You know, if you mind the picture of a kind of hyperboloid that has two families of lines that rule it, this is a complex picture, but it kind of looks like that. There are two families of two planes that cover this this Klein quadric. And these are called, you know, in Penrose notation, alpha and beta planes, and they have a special meaning in this geometry. So in terms of the twistor transform, the alpha planes are what you get. So the image in here, in this Grassmannian, of the fibers of the other projection. So if you pick a point in twistor space, you look at what lies above that point in this flag variety, and then you push it forward and that, you get one of these rulings of the Klein quadric. And so what happens, you know, if you look at this geometry, how it works, you see that in these alpha planes, every line is a light ray, you know, with respect to the, and these 2p ones that are, so these rulings by a family of cones parameterized by 2p1s, which are these, like I said before, they are the base of a light cone. And so when that on the real points that give you exactly the fact that your Lorentzian spacetime is covered with light cones in the usual sense of Minkowski's geometry. And the beta planes has a similar interpretation in terms of the dual Penrose transform, where you take the dual space of the four-dimensional space. So there's a duality between these two families of planes. So now, I mean, how general are the classes of Lorentzian manifolds, Lorentzian spacetimes, that you can fit into this kind of picture? And there's essentially a characterization of which kind of Lorentzian geometries you can describe in these algebraic geometric terms. They're called Grassmann-Spinor structures. So essentially the crucial point is whether you have an isomorphism of the space of one form with this tensor product of two plane bundles. And once you have that, you can pretty much go through the old picture that I described before. And in particular, this includes the Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes. You can fit them inside this kind of picture. And so here's, you know, as I said, this story that I recalled up to now is not new. It goes back to this development of twistor theory a long time ago. So you know, some of the main reference, actually Manning's book is very detailed on the geometry of all these things, and it has all the details on this point of view. Yeah, you mean if you can fit things that are more anisotropic
infinitesimal perturbations of
FRW? Yeah, the thing is, you know, as long as your perturbation is coming from the metric, that's not a problem because your metric is some section of some bundle, so you can and deform which section you choose, as long as you know the underlying geometry is not, so the underlying topology is not changed. So it's there are some constraints on what kind of topologies you can accommodate in this picture, but in terms of you have pretty good freedom of moving around the structure of the metric by the choice of which sections you want to use. So let's just go to some examples of things. So we know that, okay, for example, Penrose in recent years have been promoting this sort of idea about this conformally cyclic cosmology, which, I mean, you know, it's controversial in terms of what the physical predictions and physical aspects of the models are, but it gives an example of something that one might want to think about. So what the main idea that Penrose is describing in this model is the fact that you can have a space-time that has, you know, a point singularity, like Big Bang-like origin, and is expanding. So it has a large, the metric gets large at infinity in the future infinity, and it has a singularity at past infinity. And you know, what he proposes is to glue together two spacetimes of this kind. So glue the future infinity of one of them to the past infinity of the next one, the next eon or epoch or whatever. And of course, you cannot do that by gluing the metrics because one of them is blowing up and the other has a singularity. But what he proposes saying is that, okay, you don't glue the metrics, you glue the conformal structure. So what you can do is you can make a conformal transformation of the metric that takes your large future infinity down to a point, and in a way that there's no discontinuity in the conformal structure. And so his proposal is, you know, if anything that will only depend on the conformal structure will go through from one stage to the next without seeing a singularity, but anything that depends on the metric through something which is not just the conformal structure will see the singularity. So in a sense, whatever physics you can have that only depends on the conformal structure will go through, and whatever, you know, depends on more than that will behave as the singularity. Okay, well, of course, as I said, there are several controversial aspects. There were some claims of ripples in the background radiation from previous eon, which have somehow been criticized. And also, there are more serious problems with this model. One of them is that it doesn't seem to be compatible with inflationary cosmology, and which is not a problem with respect to what we know about the current models of the universe, what seem to be confirmed about the current models of the universe. And also, one can wonder, this is a proposal for a kind of cyclic cosmology. Well, does it fit with other kind of cyclic cosmologies like the Steiner-Turok? Or what happens if you have a kind of universe that approaches the singularity in a very anisotropic and chaotic way, like this sort of mixed master cosmologist, what happens in a case like that? So there's some issue. And so, for example, you can ask, how can you think about some of these issues from this algebra geometric point of view, and what do you get? So these are some of the some of the discussions that happened around these claims on the Penrose model, including one of the last attempts by Penrose to answer some of this criticism. But in a sense, the point of view that I'm taking here is that I'm not trying to propose Penrose model as a viable physical model. I'm just trying to say, is there something that we can extract from that idea that is worth thinking about in terms of what kind of geometry one can try to construct that has this sort of feature where you glue something, some space-time to another space-time across some kind of singularity. So let me come down to how you might want to try to do that using this algebra geometric setup that I described before. So there's one operation that's very useful in algebraic geometry, which is the blow up of a subvariety inside another variety. So we assume for a moment that everything that we're, all the loci subvarieties and varieties we're looking at are smooth. So by the way, when I mean smooth from the algebra geometric point of view, which is not the same as smooth in terms of the metric structure. So smooth from this just means that these are, as algebraic varieties, they're smooth. You can still put on them a metric that is singular somewhere. That's a different issue. So there's different notions of singularities around. So suppose that you have a smooth subvariety of some codimension n plus at least one, so some codimension n plus one, inside a smooth projective variety. So blowing up the subvariety is an operation that produces a new algebraic variety, which is also smooth and projective. So it remains in the class of nicest possible algebraic varieties you can work with. And it has a projection down to the original variety. So it's something that covers it and projects down to the original variety. And the nice feature that this projection has is that everywhere except at the locus that you're blowing up, this projection is an isomorphism. So you have the same, basically the same coordinates, the same variety, the same thing, except along this subvariety. And what is it that lies above the subvariety? That's called the exceptional divisor. That's, you know, whatever lies above what you're blowing up. So what that is a projective bundle. It's a projectivization of the normal bundle of the subvariety inside the original variety. So if you think about what that means is that, okay, you have some subvariety. So what you imagine doing is like you take a tubular neighborhood. I mean, you cannot do that in algebra geometric terms, but that's morally what you're doing. You take a tubular neighborhood and you open it up. So you're in such a way that everything away from where that's where the difference between the algebra geometric thing and a differential geometric thing would be. In a differential geometric setting, if you take out a tubular neighborhood, you're taking out a piece of the complement of the thing, but here the complement stays the same everywhere, except that where you have the subvariety, now you have a thicker thing, a larger thing, which is this projective bundle. But everything is, from the algebra geometric perspective, nice and smooth, so nothing has changed except this thing. Okay? So you're altering things only above this subvariety. Okay, so that's the picture.
And there are generically several different ones.
Hmm?
Am I right that there are generically several different ones? Or is it?
No, it's just so. It's just as that away from the subvariety, you just have the same thing. It's just this projection is just an isomorphism, and over the subvariety you have this projectivization of the normal bundle. So you have this projective, over each point of the subvariety, you have a projective space. And the projective space of dimension, the codimension minus one of the subvariety. That's. So let's propose a general setting about what to do. So what do I do if I want to construct a model when I glue together two spacetimes?
So this Voronoi subvariety basically then has effectively the same dimension as the larger spacetime, is that right? In other words, the dimension of the original variety plus the dimension of the...
Right, so let's think about the case where the subvariety is just a point. Okay, so I take a point and I blow it up. So what it means is just that I'm replacing the point with the projective space of all directions at that point. Okay. So instead of that point, I have a whole space of directions that are now different points.
Is that a sphere? So that case, it sounds like the blow up is two dimensional. So
hmm? Right. Yeah, Alexa, I'll come to some very explicit in a moment, so maybe they'll clarify a little bit more the picture. But yeah, in a sense, what I'm thinking of is that you want to.
I'm asking is, does the blown up space match the dimension of the ambient, the larger space?
Right. So that you start with a subvariety which is in some. Possibly very low dimension, maybe a point. The pre-image of this subvariety in the blow up is always a divisor, so it's always a codimension one thing. So that's what it does. So it replaces something which is of very low dimension with something which is always of codimension one. Which would be like, you know, if I would take a tubular neighborhood and I would take the boundary of the tubular neighborhood, the boundary of the tubular neighborhood would always be a hypersurface, even if the thing of which I'm taking the tubular neighborhood is a very low dimension. That's right.
Something of codimension one, but I don't interpret that as the boundary of the thing.
Right, in a sense, you want to think of this as being the boundary of a tubular neighborhood, except that no, the advantage here is that you can do that without removing anything. The complement stays exactly the same, but yeah. So that, let's make a proposal for what to do. So suppose that I want to glue together two spacetimes. What do I do? Okay, so the kind of setting scenario that I'm setting up is something like this. You have two complex four-dimensional manifolds that are smooth, maybe not necessarily projective, means that they might not be compact, but maybe we can assume that they are also compact, like these Grassmannians or projective spaces. So what will happen, that will mean is that inside each of these complex four-dimensional manifolds, there will be a real locus, which is your actual physical space-time. But you think of them inside two complex things. And now you want to glue together these two complex things. So the other data that you want to have is a smooth projective two-dimensional quadric that's sitting inside. So I think M minus has been my past ion and M plus has been the next one that I want to glue together.
Why are these complex manifolds?
Well, that's the old setup that I described at the beginning. Like, you can always embed things like starting with flat Minkowski space or Friedman's Robertson Walker cosmology as real loci inside some complex algebraic varieties. The thing is, like, you know, you can embed inside the typical thing would be a Grassmannian of two planes in a four-dimensional space. So what I want to do is, embed my real Minkowski spaces as real loci inside some complex four-dimensional manifold, and then use this algebra geometric to patch together the complex manifolds, and then see what happens to the real loci, and what goes through and what doesn't go through in this sense, like .
So the complex part is important.
You mean what? Well, in a sense, what I'm using the complex structure for is that it allows me to. Certain things become simpler when you think about it in terms of that. I mean, the basic idea is that real algebraic geometry is very complicated. Complex algebraic geometry is very simple compared to real one.
Oh, okay.
So whenever you want to use algebraic geometric technique, what you do is you complexify your coordinates, and then at the end you take real points. And because that kind of simplifies your life a lot. That's basically, yeah. And so you take another piece of the data that you pick is, so you require that these four-dimensional manifolds has a quadric sitting inside, which is like a pair of projective lines. So this will be like the base of the light cone at infinity, and what you would want to do is glue that to something in the next piece. So we find something that matches that in the other piece. So let require that the next piece has a three-dimensional complex space, which is isomorphic to a neighborhood of the vertex of the cone with base. These two, and that all of these embeds as a closed submanifold in the next piece. So in terms of the picture that I described at the beginning with the Grassmannians and so on, what I'm going to do is basically match the future boundary that we described in terms of light cones of one spacetime to the past boundary of the next one. So what you want to construct or have as part of what allows you to do the gluing is an explicit isomorphism of these quadrics in these two places. So the way you proceed to do this gluing is in the second piece, you take the blow up at a point. And the point that you blow up is the vertex of the cone that has based these pairs of projective spaces. So then what you do is you glue the past piece inside the future piece by matching the quadrics by, you know, in that comment that you have in this like cone in the past piece, and you want to glue it to the one that lies in the exceptional divisor of the blow up of the next one. So if you want to, what I have in mind is that, so the you think of the point that you're blowing up as being the singularity of the next eon. So the Big Bang singularity of the next eon. So you replace that with your projective space. So it's no longer a point singularity. You have now a whole projective space. And inside there, you can fit what is coming from the light cone at infinity of the previous eon. And so let us, you know, just be a little more concrete and look at the more specific examples of what these two four manifolds, what you can take as these two four manifolds. So I'm going to make an example when I take two that are not necessarily the same. So yeah, because, you know, you can have embeddings of Minkowski spaces inside in different ways inside, I don't know, complex varieties. So one of them, you know, I'm going to take the one that I described at the beginning, where I take the Klein quadric in P5, the embedding of the Grassmannian of two planes in a four-dimensional space inside P5. You know, and so I take that as my second piece, and I'm going to blow up that at a point. So a point, so now this Q has complex dimension 4, so a point has codimension 4, so M plus 1 is 4, so the exceptional divisor of this blow up is a P3, a three-dimensional projective space. And as the other piece, let's just take a P4. And so the P4 has also a big cell, which is just a fine space, and its compactification is a P3. So the boundary is a P3. And now what I do is, to this one, I also do a blow up, but I blow up this at a P1 that's lying inside this P3 at infinity. So this P3 in turn is an A3 with a P2, and the P2 is an A2 with a P1, so I can pick a P1 and I blow up that P1. Okay. And now the exceptional divisor, I'm blowing up something which is of dimension 1 inside something of dimension 4. The exceptional divisor now has over this P1, there's a P1 at every point, so the exceptional divisor is a P1 times P1. Well, now I have to look at what happens to the real points, because that in the end I'm interested in, you know, fishing back my real space times in this whole picture. So the real involution, as I said, in this Grassmannian, you know, the way you put the real structure so that you get the right Minkowski metric when you restrict these tensors on the real points of the big cell is the ones that exchanges the bundle S and S tilde. So this means it exchanges the two P1s in this in the light cones, in the complexified light cones. So the set of real points of the quadric are just a two sphere. It's the P1 lying diagonally inside the product of the P1. So it's topologically it's a two sphere. And while in this P4, the real locus is just the real points of P4. So a four-dimensional real projective space. And the boundary at infinity is then this P3 in this case, which contains this embedded two sphere S2. And when you interpret what this sphere is in P3 is the common base at infinity of all the light cones in the real Minkowski space, which is, you know, the part of the big cell minus this boundary. So, and in the Klein quadric, you look at the real points. You just looking at the real points of this quadric inside the a real P5. So it's we'll get picture, and over each point of this quadric, you have a this is a four-dimensional right inside P5, and you can look at P4s that are so hyperplanes in P5 that are tangent to this quadric. So at each point, actually, there is one four-dimensional projective space that is tangent to the quadric at that point. That it's like if you have this hyperboloid picture and you look at a point, you have two lines that go through that point. So you have a plane that's tangent to the, at that point to the hyperboloid, and it sort of cuts it. The hyperboloid cuts through. So there's a similar picture here, except in dimension, in higher dimension. And the intersection. So when you see how this before, it's like with this hyperboloid. Like when you cut the you cut an hyperboloid with the tangent plane at the point, you get curves of which are where the hyperboloid intersects the tangent plane. And what you get here when you look at how this tangent P4s intersect the quadric, you get a compactified light cone at that point. It's a way to see the light cones in these space times. And if you look at the complement of this light cone, so through each point.
If you can draw a picture, that would be, I mean, you see me drawing a lot of pictures in the air.
But yeah, that's right. So, I mean, the picture is somewhat like this, except it's in some higher dimension, so it's a bit difficult. But if you have something like this, and you know that there are two lines that go, this kind of the hyperboloids are covered by two families of lines, and so if you pick a point, there's a plane that's tangent to it at that point, which is covered by these two lines, and this plane, the way that this plane intersects the surface, cuts out a cone, which is the given by the cone made by these lines, and this is the light cone. So if you pick one light cone, you can think of that as being the light cone at infinity, and what is left is the rest of your space-time covered by other light cones. So that's the picture. So what you get is a compactification of your real Minkowskian space-time, where you see the boundary at infinity is one of these cones, the cone at infinity, and the rest of it is covered by the other light cones. That's So, I mean, this is sort of the picture in a lower dimension, but it's very similar to what happened.
So, the Minkowski space we're talking about, is that outside the hyperboloid? I guess I'm just trying to get the picture here. So, where is the Minkowski space?
This itself would be, so the Minkowskian space-time would be the complement of one of these cones in this hyperboloid. When you take all these hyperboloid, it would be the compactified Minkowska space-time. It would be like these Penrose diagrams that have the it's a way of thinking of the. I mean, when you draw these Penrose diagrams with the future infinity and past infinity, you're really drawing this boundary, this cone, and you're looking at the interior of your diagram is whatever everything else. That's okay. Yeah. So this is somehow the picture, except everything is in four dimensions rather than at all. But it's pretty much how you're representing things. So this basically you have the following situation that you have the same space resulting space that you're obtaining in two different ways. One is by blowing up this quadric at a point, and the other one is by blowing up this P4 at this two sphere. And so these two things now can be matched after doing these operations. So I'll explain a little bit better what I mean by crossing over from one to the next. But basically, in this picture, you have, for example, if you want to match the conformal classes, what you do is you pick sections of these bundles that I described before over both of these pieces, and you match. If you want to match the conformal classes of the matrix would just be sections with the corresponding projective bundle, because it's up to a conformal factor, and you want to match those sections over this common piece. And of course, you know, there's some things you want to keep in mind, which is that which is orientations, because sometimes, you know, this, when you look at this space, this real loci, you might have an issue with orientability, and you need to pass consistently to an orientation double cover of everything. But it's just something that can be done, because, you know, when you, these are all coming from projective spaces, Grassmannians, and embedding of Grassmannians in projective spaces, and all of the real structures and the universal covers are consistently compatible with the map. So if you have to, you know, pass to the double cover, is you can do it consistently with all the maps. So that's another issue why, you know, the complex varieties are better behaved, because when you look at real loci in complex varieties, one thing that often you have to worry about it are these non-orientable things that you happen. So then you need a way to consistently pass to orientation double cover through everything you're doing. Whereas, you know, if you first work with the complex things, you don't have to worry about these things, and then at the end you just check that everything is consistent. So otherwise you carry on all these issues in the picture. Okay, so let's, for example, see that, you know, in case you have two ways to go across this gluing of these two ions. So for example, one idea is this: you identify the three-dimensional projective space that's coming from blowing up a point in the quadric with the three-dimensional projective space, which is the infinity of the P4. So that, you know, the corresponding spheres of null directions are identified with the base of the light cones on the other side. So that's one way you match a P3 to a P3. And another thing is you identify the exceptional divisor of the blow up of the sphere in P3 with the divisor of the with the pre-image under the other blow up of this light cone, so this boundary at infinity of the other one. So basically you're matching. So this second picture is in a sense similar to what Penrose was proposing. So you are taking the future infinity of the first ion and matching it to a Big Bang, you know, with this blown up transformation of the second ion. And this first matching of blowing up at a point with the hyperplane in the other one is actually maybe something that can suggest a way to build a model in this framework that looks a little bit more like a kind of inflation and multiverse scenario. I'll say in a moment how that works. So what I have in mind is something like this. So you want to build a kind of model where you can have things bubbling off, like universe is bubbling off from something. So a kind of multiverse landscape that looks like this. So can you fit something like this in this framework? Well, there's one discretized model of this idea of this multiverse, which was recently by, I don't know, Suskin and people, this eternal symmetry picture where you think of this bubbling off as happening along a tree, and you sort of with terminal vacua that cut the tree at some point. Well, so what I want to do is pick something like this and fleshing it out by, you know, plugging in these projective spaces that do the chunks, the space times. So there is a nice way to do that, which is already available. So there's a nice algebra geometric construction, which is this pointed rooted trees of projective spaces. So this comes from another source in algebraic geometry, which is, you know, when people study moduli spaces of curves, they find that, you know, so if you have some kind of nice algebraic curve, which means a Riemann surface, and they come in families, these families sometimes degenerate, and they degenerate by pinching off some of these curves. And then in the boundaries, you find things that are this kind of trees of projective spaces with mark points, or projective lines with mark points, and they sort of populate the boundary of these moduli spaces of curves. So it's basically our trees where every vertex of the tree is occupied by a P1, and these P1s are attached at points, and then they have some kind of ends, which are the mark points that make the curve stable. So there's a higher dimensional generalization of this picture where you have a similar situation, but so you have a tree, but each vertex of the tree is occupied by a projective space of some fixed dimension. But now you have to say what it means to glue them together, because if you glue them together at a point, you get something that's very unstable. So what replaces gluing two P1s at a point is taking two projective spaces. So you have, and you pick a point in one of them, and you fix a hyperplane in the other one, and then you blow up this point. So this is the blow-up, which is the same everywhere else, except that it replaces the point by a hyperplane, and then you glue these two together. So you match this hyperplane to this one. And that's so you have a PM glued together along this hyperplane with the blow-up at the point of another one.
So when you say it's very unstable when you join another.
Yeah, you still need to. Stable here means, so if you have a, you know, that you don't have too many moduli. I mean, you don't have too many, you know, ways to deform. Okay, so if I have a P1, once I fix three points, it's rigid. So it means that all of these components have to have three points that are either, you know, attached to something else or marked, so that then it's stable in the sense that, you know, it becomes rigid. And so this does the same thing. And of course, you might still have some marked points around that are enough to make it. So you get a similar picture where you get these trees of projective spaces. So that's the idea that's described in more detail here. And these objects have, you know, these trees of projective spaces have the nice feature that also they have moduli. So there's a moduli space that, like the moduli space of rational curves with marked points, describes these trees of projective spaces. And so you can think that, you know, now your picture of a sort of a, you know, that, well, What you want to have as a picture like this would be something like these gluings that I described, where, you know, so each bubble is one P4, and this P4 has a P3, which is coming from is the infinity, the compactification. So inside this P4, there's a Minkowski, there's a Lorentzian space, and inside this P3, there is its boundary at infinity. And then you have another P4, and this has a point which you think as what you take as the bubbling of this from here, meaning that you blow up this point and you glue it to this, and that creates a picture that kind of looks like this, and so you keep going and you create a tree of bubbles, and this whole thing. So inside here, there are your space times that get correspondingly, and the fact that these objects have moduli means that, so there's a moduli space of these things, means that if you want to have, you have a nice space of fields, you know, that live on this on this picture. And you know, you have a.
So, I guess maybe I missed the beginning. So why part modulus?
Right. So in the case of curves, right? For example, if you have elliptic curves, you know that there's a modulus that defines the isomorphism class of the elliptic curves. So if there's a moduli space of elliptic curves, which is, you know, this tau is in the upper half plane, but you know that you mod out by SL2Z because, you know, that whenever two taus are related by an SL2Z transformation, they give isomorphic elliptic curves. So the space that parameterizes elliptic curves is this space. So this is the moduli space of curves of genus 1. Okay. And in a similar way, you have a moduli space of curves of genus G with n mark points. And in particular, M0n is a very well-studied object because it has a, so these are curves of genus 0 with n mark points. So there are the smooth points is just a P1 with a bunch of points. But what is interesting is that then you have a boundary where these, you know, for example, splits into two components, and some of the mark points go here and some go there, or splits into one of these pictures here. So there's a nice compactification of this that accounts for all these trees of P1s. And this object here is a very nice algebraic variety in itself, so one knows about the cohomology of these things, or differential form, interesting differential forms over this. So there's like a space of interesting fields, meaning things like differential forms, cohomology classes, functions, and so on, that are defined over this object. And that, you know, so they describe things like this in families. But so, for example, I mean, these moduli spaces enter a lot in string theory because you can define expectation values of something as integrals of some differential forms over these moduli spaces. So, in that sense, that's why I'm thinking of these as being fields that live over these data. So, in a sense, what I think here is that you produce this kind of multiverses. And they come in families because you have a nice moduli space that describes how you can, you know, deform these in families, and you have a nice, you know, set of fields associated to these things. And in a similar way, you can make a picture in twistor space where, you know, you glue the P3s of the twistors rather than gluing the P4s of the spacetimes. And you produce other, you know, similar pictures like that. So if you do it with the twisters, you might, you know, wonder, okay, when I glue, so now I have these P3s that are the twisters, and I glue two of them together again by, you know, having a hyperplane here and a point and blowing this up and gluing them together. You might wonder if what you get by gluing two twister spaces together is still the twister space of a good spacetime. So if you do it here, you kind of construct the twister space, and then you want to go back to the space-time as the dual of what you construct. And in principle, it might not be clear that if you glue together two twister spaces, you get something that's still the twister space of something else. But there's an old result by Donaldson and Friedman that tells you that this may not be, but there's an algebra geometric deformation of this that will be. So somewhere in the vicinity of this, in the sense of these moduli spaces, there is something which is the twister space of an actual space. So you can do this construction and then deform it algebra geometrically inside this moduli space and actually get a corresponding space-time that correspond to these gluings. So that's two dual pictures of how you can do this sort of multiverse scenarios in this sense. And, well, now let me take a little stroll down the alley of wild speculations. You might wonder, so what if I do some kind of gluing like this, how am I to interpret time across these gluings? Because, you know, I'm saying, okay, I glue the future infinity of one space-time with the past infinity of the next space-time. But what happens to time where I glue them? How is this infinity supposed to go back to minus infinity? Okay. So let's try to look a little bit more at some cases of this model and see if there's something that comes up that kind of does that trick. Okay. Well, so let's look at the case of Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology. And as usual, you can write it in the standard form where you take the dimensionless coordinates and put it in this way. And let me just focus on the case where k is zero, that these things are flat. That's not too bad given what we know. And so that what happens, this is again something classical and not so what's out there in the literature, just write this. So you can write the you look at this factor r of t, this function r of t, you look at what the Friedman equation gives you for that, with the conservation, the fluid conservation equation. And the thing is, once you do that, you can actually write a good global time coordinate in terms of a function that you write, so a function of this r, that you write by this equation. So now if you stare at it, you see that this in terms of these coordinates r and y, so in the plane, the r-y plane, again thought of as complex coordinates for the moment, this defines an elliptic curve. So there's an elliptic curve out there, and your global time coordinate is a kind of period integral over this elliptic curve. It's some integral of an algebraic differential form on this elliptic curve. So what you get by just staring at this?
A and B here.
Hmm?
What is A and B?
What is what?
A and B.
Oh, A and B are two parameters which are actually depending on also. So they are functions of the matter and energy densities. I'm not writing them out explicitly, but I mean you have these matter and energy densities, and those parameters will depend on those. So in particular, you're right, this is not just one elliptic curve, it's a family of elliptic curves because A and B are also changing. They depend on these densities.
I get the physical meaning of this Y parameter, is that something I should recognize?
So I'm not writing that. I mean, this is in the literature. I can the references, but I mean the point is this: that when you look at these at the Friedman equation for R, you can write a good and you look at R that solves this equation, you can write a good global time coordinates in this way, where Y is a function of R in that form, where A and B are functions of these matter and energy density. Right, so what I'm saying is if you take this integral where y is defined in this way, then this gives you something that behaves like a good global time coordinate.
Okay, but does this coincide with the FRW time or not?
I think you're saying t in that formula is not the standard time.
Right.
R is the scale factor, y is defined by the top equation, and tau is
yeah.
Right. I guess that's what I'm trying to see because I want to see what time coordinate that is. And it's a good time coordinate. You mean it's just monotonic in the whole time?
That's right.
Right.
You can think of it like as a global time or something for.
Yeah, I guess the thing that puzzles me is that I think there are too few terms that are there in that equation. It's just because, usually you would think of that, you have dark matter, you have radiation, you have cosmological constant, you have curvature, they all have different scalings with R. So I'm a bit puzzled that you have only three terms, you have only R.
You may be right that you might be assuming some slightly more things. You may be right. But I'm making this point just because if you do this, you can think of a good global time as being described in terms of a curve, a real curve, on a certain algebraic surface, which is a family of elliptic curves. Okay, so a family of elliptic curves. So you have a moduli space of elliptic curves, which is this modular curve. By the way, this modular curve is also isomorphic to a P1. The coordinate of the P1 is the J invariant of the elliptic curve. So you have a family of elliptic curves is a curve in this in this modular surface. So you have, as part of geometry, also something which is this family of elliptic curves and this modular curve that parameterizes them. So let me also see another place where, so just look now at another case where I'm also going to come up with something that will look like a curve on a modular surface. So let's take another example, which is this kind of mixed master-like cosmology. So now we have a very anisotropic kind of space-time. And you look at Kasner solutions, so Kasner metrics, where you have scaling, different scalings of parameter with these constraints, which take care of the Bianchi identities and everything for the metric. And these also have a singularity. When you write them in these coordinates, they're singular at t equals zero, or you can put logarithmic time if you want your singularity at minus infinity. And so this is an old model going back to the 70s, but they have some interesting features. So there's these mixed master-like models. They are models where solutions look locally like one of these Kasner metrics, meaning there are long stretches of time, which are these Kasner epochs, during which the solution is well approximated by one of these Kasner metrics, and then it changes to another one according, and the way it goes, it's described by a discrete dynamical system that tells you how you go from one Kasner epoch to the next. And a way to describe these solutions is also in terms of a dynamical system on the boundary of a compactification of phase space in the Bianchi 9 model. But no, I'm not going to go through the details of this. It's all very old literature. But what I want to extract from that is the fact that one thing is that the space that's involved to give this dynamical system description of these solutions is the same blow-ups that I was talking about a moment ago. So these blow-ups at the point which will be the Big Bang singularity of these mixed master models of your space-time. So it's constructed, these kind of solutions are constructed exactly on the same space that I'm using. So it makes sense to look at these models in this context. But, and also, so this is the typical picture of one of these mixed master cosmologies. You have a Kasner epochs during which one of the directions is responsible for expansion or contraction, depending in which direction you're looking. And the other two directions oscillate. And then, after you pass to another Kasner era, there may be a shuffling of the three directions. So it's not necessarily the same one that's responsible for the contraction, but the other two oscillate and so on. And the way you go from one to the next is described by a discrete dynamical system, which has to do with the shift of the continued traction expansion points. So you get the next exponents, P1, P2, and P3 of the Kasner epoch from the previous ones by transformation that are either subtracting an integer or this continued fraction shift. And okay, so I said this is all rather old literature, and all the details of this description are in these old papers. But what is interesting from the point of view that I just described is that also this description leads you to think about time in this setting as a curve, or a real curve on the modular curve that parameterizes elliptic curves. The reason for that is that this discrete dynamical system that describes the evolution of the Kasner metrics and so on, it is describable in terms of continued fraction expansion and the shift of the continued fraction expansion. And in particular, this, if you want to take into account both the times of the Kasner epoch and the exponent of the Kasner matrix, there's a transformation that does both of them at the same time, and it's this double-sided shift of the continued fraction expansion. And what this does is actually a good discrete dynamical system that codes the geodesic flow on the modular curve. So the dynamics of the shift of continued fraction expansion is equivalent to the action of PGL2Z on P1 of R, and that in turn is equivalent to coding the geodesic flow on this modular curve here, on this moduli space of elliptic curve. And this discrete dynamical system is just a Poincaré return map for the geodesic flow. So you can think of this Kasner evolution as being equivalent to drawing a curve, a real curve, in this complex curve, which is the moduli space of elliptic curves. So these are two different examples where by two different paths, you come to view the time near the singularity as something that can be thought of as a curve on this moduli space of elliptic curves. So, okay, this stuff that I talked about in terms of geodesics on the modular curve are from sort of previous work done some time ago. But so let's try to use this as a way to sort of speculate a little bit about how one could think of time at the gluing between this future infinity of one eon and past infinity of the other eon. So you're coming from the previous, the old space-time, and you're reaching plus infinity as your time coordinate. And then this is glued through this blow-up construction to the next eon, where your time is starting at minus infinity with the Big Bang singularity. So what is to happen to time at the gluing? How is it supposed to go from this plus infinity down back to the minus infinity? So what you can think of is that when you get near this singularity, time is better described by something which is a curve on a P1. So you can think of time as being a complex P1, rather than a real P1. And you're just seeing the real part where you're coming from this previous eon, and you'll still see the real part when you take off into the next eon. But when you are at this gluing, you sort of go through the imaginary part of this P1, and this P1 is that P1, and you go through it following a curve that depends on parameterizing your time near the singularity by some curve on this moduli space of elliptic curves by one of these methods that I described, and that allows you to go through complex. You can think of it as, complex time, but I mean, what it really is this parameterization over on this curve. And then, once you are back into your future space-time, it just goes back to being time in the usual real sense. Okay, as I said, this is down the alley of wild speculations, but it kind of fits with these pictures that make you think of.
Geodesic and those I guess modular curves, is that what you were saying? I guess I'm just wondering how do you determine the geodesics on those modular curves?
Right. So yeah. No. So I mean, if you suppose that I'm going, suppose that my next epoch is approaching the Big singularity through one of these mixed master thing. So okay, there you have this kind of oscillating behavior. You look, but so what I'm saying is that if I'm sufficiently near the singularity here, I can parameterize my time evolution by this kind of Kasner epochs and so on. So, I can describe the time evolution equivalently by assigning. I can describe this time evolution by assigning a curve on the I'm assigning a geodesic on the modular curve. Well, when I talk about geodesic, I'm really thinking of it as being, you know, geodesic. So I have it's the upper half plane, and you know, my geodesics are things like this.
Okay.
And so it's just the hyperbolic metric on the upper half plane, and so I have geodesic. Well, they could be just like this, or they could be circles with anyway, they are things that go in this complex plane, and so it, you know, what they look like here. So if the endpoints are rational, so here with this metric, this looks like a sphere that has a cusp, and the cusp here is what happens to the rational points. They're all sent to this cusp point. The irrational points don't go anywhere in the boundary, but so if you have a geodesic that goes to an irrational point, it just kind of keep winding around here. So, but I mean, the...
And the rational point basically has start and end on that corner or on the puncture?
If I have a geodesic, for example, if I, you know, start at zero and I take a geodesic that goes like this, so it's something that will either, you know, end up at the cusp or start at the cusp and go around. And if it ends at another rational point, it will rather than end again at the cusp. And this. So.
Are you close to the end, or
yeah, I'm close. I'm pretty much close. Maybe can I take another 5 minutes, or is it? Yeah. So I just want to say one thing that, you know, if you, there's another question that is what happens near the singularity. Is there any remnants of something that so could have a quantum nature near the singularity that you can fit in this type of picture? So one thing that can be fit, can be compatible with the picture that I described, is the idea of having some non-commutativity of the space-time coordinates near the singularity. So, you know, one possibility that, for example, this was a picture that was very popular some years ago because of, you know, compactifications of certain kind of string theories that would produce, you know, I guess at Planck scales, some non-commutativity of space-time coordinates. So there are some, you know, possibilities, or at least some models where, you know, one might be able to see some kind of quantum gravity effects by, you know, the presence of some kind of non-commutativity, at least near the, you know, near the singularity. This is something that has been, you know, people have been looking at. I just put some couple of references, but there are more people are trying to look at whether, you know, the presence of non-commutativity in the space-time coordinate can leave some detectable traces in cosmological terms. I mean, things that one could see in the background radiation of things like that. So it's, you know, a question is whether you can fit this type of picture in the same story. And so the way to do that is that, you know, you put it in a framework where you can describe, you know, metrics and things like that in a non-commutative setting, which is, you know, the spectral triples thing. And in particular, you want to say that, you know, you can deform your manifold to something non-commutative. So you can think that if you go to sufficiently high energies, you produce one of these deformations to something non-commutative, some picture like that. And however, because we are working with something, so there's a good framework like this, which are the theta deformations of Kohn and Landy. They have the advantage of being isospectral, which means they don't touch anything that has to do with the metric. The metric structure interpreted in the suitable sense in the non-commutative world stays the same as you had in the commutative case, but the algebra of coordinates becomes non-commutative. And this works well when you have a torus acting by isometries on your variety. And however, no, we want something which is more algebra geometric because our constructions are based on the algebra geometric setting. And so there's a more algebra geometric generalization of this picture, Cherulandi and Szabo, that basically replaces the tori in the real sense, so products of copies of S1, with tori in the algebra geometric sense, called products of copies of C star, of the multiplicative group. And so the idea of these deformations is that basically you just, if you have a torus that is acting on your variety, you take the algebra of functions and you decompose it into Fourier modes with respect to the torus action. And then you can make the product non-commutative by basically making the torus that's acting non-commutative and make these Fourier components commute up to a phase factor as in a non-commutative torus. And the thing is that this can be made compatible so that the metric structure that described by Dirac operator and the representation in algebra stays the same in the deformation. And this generalization works by, as I said, by replacing tori in the real sense with tori in the complex sense, and with copies of the multiplicative group of C star. And so the point here is that so we have, in our picture, we have either P4s or Grassmannians. And so we want to make sure that what we are doing with projective spaces and Grassmannians, including these blow-ups and blow-growing things and so on, can all be done compatibly with these non-commutative deformations. And this works because you can actually deform the Grassmannian precisely by deforming its embedding in P5, which is this Klein quadric that I've been using. And so one basically deforms the P5 and deforms the coordinates of the Plucker embedding so that they consistently give you a deformation of the Grassmannian, basically by making the coordinates commute up to some phase factors as if they were a commutative torus. And the algebra coordinates of the Grassmannian gets deformed by these angles, these phase factors. And there's some simple conditions that you can check that will ensure that the deformation of the Grassmannian and the deformation of the projective space are compatible. And again, the main references are these recent works. And the point is that you can do this deformation so that the whole construction that I talked about, the blow-ups, the gluing, and everything, becomes compatible with these deformations. So the idea is that if there is some kind of non-commutativity of coordinates, due to some quantum effect of some sort, this can be also carried across in these gluings across singularities in a compatible way. So that, in both cases, I think I'll just stop here. Sorry for taking a little longer.